Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen so you can take some notes during the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. An interesting and useful article from Ron Lieber of the New York Times called Seven New Rules for First-Time Home Buyer. Too many people bought too much house for too many years. Yes, the financial system almost collapsed because mortgage bankers and brokers told lies about loan terms and loosened standards in dangerous ways, and investment bankers packaged those loans into bonds that were far more toxic than rating agencies predicted. But the roots of the mortgage contagion lie with all of us and our desire to own just a bit more house. So as the one-year anniversary arrives of our near financial collapse, it's a good time to blow up a long-standing but under-examined maxim of real estate that you should always stretch financially when buying your first home. No one is quite sure who came up with this idea, though suspicions rest on real estate agents or kindly parents with the best intentions who never expected that real estate prices could fall. Whatever its origin, the economists and financial planners contacted for this article are almost unanimous in their rejection of it. Here's how they dismantled the old saw and a list of seven suggestions they offered up in its place. Suggestion number one, start with the basics. Let's begin with some other standards, tried and true advice that served banks and borrowers well for years until they forgot all about them in the race to write more loans and buy bigger houses. Put 20% down so you have less of a chance of owing more than your home is worth if prices fall again. Get a fixed rate mortgage so the biggest part of your monthly housing bill remains stable. If you're determined to be truly conservative, don't spend more than 35% of your pre-tax income on mortgage, property tax, and home insurance payments. Bank of America, which adheres to the guidelines that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac set, will let your total debt, including student and other loans, hit 45% of your pre-tax income, but no more. That said, if you end up with an adjustable rate loan, banks may not be concerned with whether you'll be able to afford the maximum possible payment when the interest rate adjusts in 5 or 7 years, but you should be worried about it. Suggestion number two, consider your income. The best case for stretching for a first house is that first-time home buyers in their 20s and 30s will probably see their incomes grow more quickly than older people buying their second or third home. Harvey S. Rosen, a Princeton economics professor, finds in a forthcoming Journal of Finance article that he co-wrote with two Federal Reserve Bank economists, Christopher Girardi and Paul Willen, that the size of a house that someone buys tends to be a good indicator of what their income will be later. People can, on average, make reasonably good predictions of their future incomes and act on them in sensible ways by buying bigger houses, Mr. Rosen said. Indeed, much of the mess in the mortgage market has been because of people borrowing money with loans that they didn't understand, or betting that housing prices would continue to rise enough that they would be able to refinance their loans before the payments rose. Income overconfidence may have had something to do with it, and high unemployment worsened the problem, but it's probably not the primary cause. So in other words, reasonable expectation for income growth needs to be considered in buying a bigger home than one can currently afford. Point number three is bow to unknowns. This research is all well and good as long as you continue to work. But if you're buying your first home before you have children, you may feel quite differently about work once you become a parent. And if you do, you may not want a mortgage boxing you in to going back to the office 3 months after the baby is born. Bobby D. Monroe, a financial planner with Fraser Financial in Atlanta, encourages younger clients in this situation to model out their budget, including any proposed mortgage, three ways: with both spouses working full-time, one working part-time, and one staying at home for a few years. She also suggests imagining or even practicing living on one income to see if it's truly realistic. What people should do is ultimately their own decision, she said, but they should do it with eyes wide open. Even people who don't want to have children need to consider this. Besides the obvious possibility of sustained unemployment, what about the need to escape a dying industry or an early midlife crisis that necessitates career change to stave off depression? Even government employees and medical residents who believe that their incomes are set for life ought to consider this possibility. Point four is map out expenses. It stands to reason that anyone tempted to stretch for a house will be inclined to play down the expense of maintaining it. These costs are anything but ancillary, though. For many years, Dennis Stearns, a financial planner in Greensboro, North Carolina, has been alarmed enough by clients' unrealistic expectations that he's maintained a home cost spreadsheet that he shares with clients shopping for houses. He also updates it periodically with aggregate real-world data based on their subsequent experiences. Mr. Stearns estimates that owners of a newer home that do some work for themselves but contract major work out to others will pay 3.6% of the original purchase price annually for maintenance and 4.5% if it's an older home. So if you own a $400,000 home, your costs will probably hit five figures each year and may rise with inflation. These expenses will be another 20% or so higher if you live in a severe weather area. He does note, however, that the tax benefits of home ownership can offset half or more of these costs in some areas of the country. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. I'm currently going over some rules from an article by Ron Lieber, Seven New Rules for the First-Time Homebuyer. Rule number five is buy best or cheapest. All of these caveats have given rise to some unusual strategies. Michael Clauscher, a financial planner with Castle Wealth Advisors in Indianapolis, suggests buying the dream house you covet, if you can afford it, or an inexpensive starter house, but not anything in the middle. If people have their heart set on something, inevitably, if they can't afford what they really want, they buy the next best thing, he said. That's absolutely the worst thing you can do. Not only do you not get what you want, but it sucks you dry. Why? Well, if you buy that entry-level home instead of the silver metal home, you can save a lot more money each month after making the house payment, as long as you're disciplined, than you would if you were paying a big mortgage toward the next best house. And all of your other housing costs will be lower too. Then, several years later, you're in a much better position to buy what you actually want. And point number six is stretch the house. Better yet, keep in mind that you don't ever have to move from that first home and incur all of the transaction costs associated with selling and buying and moving again. J. Michael Collins, an assistant professor in the Department of Consumer Science at University of Wisconsin's School of Human Ecology in Madison, suggests paying less for a home that you can upgrade periodically when your income is stable and your savings or available credit make it possible. In other words, stretching out your tenure in a home and the physical boundaries of the home itself may make more sense than stretching for each successive mortgage in a series of two or more houses. And finally, the 8-hour rule. One rule about all of these rules is that it's unlikely that every one will apply to every circumstance. Individuals and their income streams are too varied, and real estate markets are themselves unique. When all else fails, however, you can always fall back on the 8-hour test. Whatever the size of your mortgage, you have to be able to sleep soundly at night. So if an impending loan has you stretching for the Ambien, it's a pretty good sign that the loan is a bit of a stretch as well. So that's from the 7 New Rules for the First-Time Homebuyer in the New York Times. Some of these points have been addressed in this course over the last year or so in the program from Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard. And in some cases, they actually are not as clear and powerful as the arguments that she makes and which have been addressed in this course. This is why I highly recommend the books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. The main books are All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap, which go very deeply into making decisions like this article tries to help one do. You can also go back on these shows in the archives at www.kruufm.com, Life and Debt, and hear the expansion of the solutions that Professor Warren and Amelia make in their works, as the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. In the last few shows, I've been talking a lot about bankruptcy itself, Chapter 7 and Chapter 13, consumer bankruptcies, when a person, a family, gets to the point where many of the other possibilities of dealing with debt are no longer viable, and one really frankly needs to reboot their financial system and make a fresh start for themselves using the law as the leverage. One point that comes up frequently is that people do not want the concept of bankruptcy to be public. If they file a bankruptcy, they want it to be a secret. Now, of course, it's not a secret. The bankruptcy filing is based on a public record in federal court. There are ways to directly access those records online these days, usually for a minimum cost. So in that regard, bankruptcy is not a private affair. When you file the petition, all of your financial dealings, your debts, your income, your budget do become part of the public records, which are, as I said, available online and, of course, available in the courthouse itself for anyone who wants to look at them. The reality is, however, that most people do not look at those kinds of records. And frankly, even non-bankruptcy attorneys or creditor attorneys or certain large creditors even know how to do it. So that is not such a daunting issue. It is true that the bankruptcy will remain in your credit report for 10 years, which will generally have an impact on new things that you're trying to do, such as car insurance, house payments, and certainly in some places, employers are now looking for credit checks as a routine screening process for many jobs, which can lead to embarrassing explanations or worse, an excuse for not giving a job. In some areas around the country, it is true that some newspapers publish bankruptcies under legal notices, but this is not as regular, frequent, or pervasive as some of us think. In short, as a very practical matter, if you aren't a famous person, a rock star, or have flim-flammed everyone in town, most personal bankruptcies don't attract much attention. In all likelihood, most of your friends, neighbors, and coworkers won't learn that you filed bankruptcy unless you decide to tell them. In contrast, getting sued by creditors is much more likely to be published in local newspapers in the county or city in which you live and the case is filed in the legal notices. The results are often published, so the bankruptcy is much less obvious for most people in their lives. Now, once the bankruptcy is filed, what do the creditors do? For most people, the best thing about filing for bankruptcy is that the phone finally stops ringing, because once you file, creditors are legally prohibited from calling you, sending you bills, or adding interest on your loans. Basically, they can't even talk to you about your debts. If you filed a Chapter 7, they have to write off the debt and walk away from it. If you file a Chapter 13, they have to deal with your trustee and your lawyer for their share of the payments. Either way, they have to leave you alone. If you're dealing with bill collectors for months or sometimes even years, the ensuing silence may seem like a gift from heaven, but the peacefulness isn't guaranteed. The law does have one loophole, and as Professor Warren says, why should bankruptcy laws be any different? During a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, a creditor can ask you to reaffirm a debt. Now, reaffirmation is just a fancy legal word for you agreeing to pay a debt that you are about to get rid of in bankruptcy. It's basically a treat me special, don't make the bankruptcy apply to me deal. In some bankruptcy courts, when the hearings are being run for the 341 meeting with the standing trustee, people notice some individuals working the crowd, often friendly gray-haired ladies who call out various names. But we don't let the smiles fool us. They are representatives from the major creditors like Citibank, MBNA, GE, Capital Bank, Bank One, other major creditors who are looking out for people who owe them money. They are hoping that they can convince you to reaffirm debts that are about to be wiped out. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So I'm talking about reaffirmations in bankruptcy. In most places where there are bankruptcy proceedings taking place, particularly away from the big cities, these kinds of attempts are not made by the large creditors. In fact, they are not supposed to be dealing directly with the client. They're supposed to be dealing with the attorney that the client has. Usually in the non-congested areas, these attempts are made through the attorney in his or her office. And frankly, there are only a few situations where a reaffirmation should ever happen. And note that a reaffirmation really only applies, practically speaking, to something that was secured by the loan. Unsecured debt by credit card companies should never give rise to a reaffirmation taking that debt out of the bankruptcy. But sometimes an individual gets a credit card when they buy something, for example, at Best Buy or from Nebraska Furniture or other kinds of personalty vendors, and when they apply for that credit card in association with that transaction, there's a small security agreement attached to the application, which is a suggestion that whatever you buy is now secured. The ability to enforce that kind of contract varies from state to state, and one should not just think instantaneously that the threat of repossessing something by the credit card company is enforceable in your state. This is why you need an attorney to discuss this kind of situation with you. So essentially, a reaffirmation is a new contract with the creditor taking the debt out of the bankruptcy and making a statement that you will continue to pay that debt. It would be frankly crazy to do that for unsecured debt in most situations. And even if the item that you purchased is in fact secured, such as a computer, a couch, a washer, and a dryer, you should not just automatically think that you have to sign an agreement to keep possession of those items. There are a lot of variables that determine whether the creditor has the legal right to repossess the item. Again, depending on the state where you live, there's procedures that are specific to the state, and generally speaking, except for a few exceptions, the threat that they're going to repossess or take something back from you is almost always an empty threat. It costs hundreds of dollars to send a truck to your house and cart something away, and most used goods just aren't worth that much anyway. The big issue under the new law is car loans for a loan that is less than 2.5 years old on the vehicle. In that kind of situation, the law is varying tremendously from state to state, but in a state like Iowa, like 7 other states, we have a special law that basically says as long as you are current on your payment for the vehicle, and even though you filed bankruptcy, and it says in their contract that this is a default and they can repossess the vehicle, under the state law, they cannot do it as long as you are current. So even there, you do not have to sign a reaffirmation. In fact, you wouldn't want to, unless they change the terms of the contract that were greatly, greatly in your favor, and your attorney says this isn't a bad financial decision. Because if you sign the agreement and later on you can't make the payments anymore, then the car can be repossessed. Yet the amount that you would owe after they sell the vehicle, called a deficiency under the contract, is no longer covered by the bankruptcy due to the reaffirmation agreement. While on the other hand, if you never signed the reaffirmation agreement and were current for some while, then unfortunately were no longer current, they repossessed the vehicle after the bankruptcy and found a deficiency between what you owed under the contract and what they could get out of the sale of the vehicle, the deficiency goes away from the prior bankruptcy because no reaffirmation was signed. So there are some tricks here. You have to be very careful. And again, this is why you seek out expert advice in dealing with these issues. I recently heard that some credit card companies try to befriend the debtor by offering them a new credit card after they filed bankruptcy, provided, of course, that the debtor sign the reaffirmation agreement. This is as if you need more of the poison that you already choked on to find yourself in bankruptcy. If you file for bankruptcy, you have to hang tough. Do not reaffirm anything unless your lawyer advises you to. And also, do not take on any more credit cards. Don't get tricked or bullied into signing away your future before the ink is dry on your bankruptcy petition. It would be a big mistake. Another important issue is credit after bankruptcy. The question is, do people who file for bankruptcy ever get credit again? Historically, the response is, do they ever? Within 6 months of filing for bankruptcy, 84% of people had already received unsolicited offers for new credit. Many had received more than 30 offers. If you file for bankruptcy, you will discover that you are more popular with credit card companies than ever before for a variety of reasons. Although I have to admit that the current economy may have some impact on what the credit card companies have done, but I would suggest that this practice will not change too much. Just the interest will continue to go up. Why? Well, banks know that you cannot declare bankruptcy again for at least 8 years for another Chapter 7, and they believe there is a good chance that you could still be so strapped for cash that you will soon end up carrying a balance and making minimum monthly payments, rocking you to number one on their list of favorite customers. So, once again, stay away from credit card companies and all the other debt peddlers. And finally for this week, why do people go bankrupt? Does it matter why you go bankrupt? Not to the bankruptcy court, at least not usually. If you defrauded people out of money, the bankruptcy courts won't let you escape your obligations. Likewise, if you stole or embezzled money, you will have to repay the money you took. But generally, if you promised to try to pay and just didn't come through, the bankruptcy courts don't really care what went wrong. Maybe you got sick, maybe you had a gambling problem, maybe you just made some really stupid decisions. Other people might feel sympathy for you, or they might call you a lowlife, but the bankruptcy laws don't distinguish whether you have a good reason or a dumb reason for getting into trouble. Bankruptcy is about getting a capsized boat back upright and letting it sail on, without worrying about why the boat turned over in the first place. That said, you might be surprised by how many bankrupt families tell roughly the same story. Nearly 90% of people who file for bankruptcy cite just three reasons for going broke. One is job loss, two, serious illness, or three, divorce. That means that all the other reasons combined, natural disaster, victim of crime, gambling problems, drug addiction, identity theft, shopaholism, being called up for the National Guard, or plain old bad judgment, account for only about 10% of bankruptcies. In other words, the overwhelming majority of people are using the bankruptcy courts exactly as the founding fathers intended, as a second chance after something bad happens. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life. You are listening to the open source sounds of Wicked All Stars. The song is Jazz House from the album Dark Clouds, available from Magnatune.